The Writer Files, a member of the Podglomerate Network.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Greetings, scribes. Just a reminder that you can now sign up for the Writer Files Extra email newsletter and have new episodes delivered straight to your inbox. I'm sending added insights, the first shot at Writer Files merch, links to curated collections of shows like The Publishing Series and The Writer's Brain, and that's just the start. Sign up today at writerfiles.fm. It's that simple. You'll find the Writer Files Extra sign-up form, a link to listen to the archives, and more about my indie podcast production company, New Media Dojo. Just type writerfiles.fm into your web browser, and there's also a link in the show notes. I'd also like to ask for your continued support to help keep this show going. As the sole host and producer of the podcast, it's been largely a labor of love these last few years. And through the generosity of listeners like you, we can get back to a regular weekly slate of interviews. And a huge shout out to those of you who have already donated. When you sign up for the free email newsletter at writerfiles.fm, you'll see a donate button there to securely support the show through PayPal. Every donation, no matter the size, makes a huge difference. And if I provide content that is valuable to you in any way, please consider a one-time or small monthly donation. If you want the free newsletter to support the show or learn more about creating your own podcast, simply go to writerfiles.fm. Thank you, as always.
I actually read part of a story. You know, in those workshops, you always have an opportunity to read, mostly to your fellow classmates, but teachers will come and so forth. There was a scout there for a literary agent who heard me read this beginning of a story, probably didn't know that my heart was beating about a million miles per hour and I super nervous. But I always force myself to read because I think having a sense of audience is really good for thinking about what you're saying. It makes you really think about what you're reading and how it sounds and how it might sound in someone else's ear. There's something about that. So at any rate, that ended up leading me to get my first agent way before I was ready. They were like, do you have a manuscript? I was like, I could have a manuscript. I kind of basically thought, well, someone's offering me, extending a hand, so I'm going to just see what happens.
And welcome back to The Writer Files. I am still your humble host, Kelton Reed, wishing you wisdom, words, and wherewithal per usual. Critically acclaimed debut author Jocelyn Nicole Johnson spoke to me about becoming a late-stage literary debutante, Walmart militias, and the writing life as an introvert. Jocelyn's a veteran public school art teacher whose short story, Control Negro, was anthologized in Best American Short Stories 2018, guest edited by New York Times bestselling author Roxane Gay, and read live by LeVar Burton as part of PRI's Selected Shorts series. Her buzzy debut is 2021 Kirkus Prize finalist My Monticello, 5 stories in a novella, all set in Virginia. It's been described as a precisely imagined novel exploring burdened inheritances and extraordinary pursuits of belonging set in the near future. It was selected by National Book Award winner Charles Yu as his most anticipated book of the year, hailed as a masterly feat by the New York Times, called Electrifying by Colson Whitehead, and Absolutely Unforgettable by Roxane Gay. Netflix recently bought the title novella, My Monticello, for adaptation, and Jocelyn's writing has appeared in Guernica, The Guardian, Quilly, Joyland, and others, and she's been a fellow at Tin House, Hedgebrook, and VCCA. In this file, Jocelyn and I discussed what inspired her quasi-dystopian fiction, how she was discovered at a short story reading, why getting tweeted by Roxane Gay was a game changer, how to build a writing community as a wallflower, and a lot more. Stay calm and write on. If you're a fan of the Writer Files, please click follow to automatically see new interviews in your podcatcher as soon as they're published. And please drop us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to help other writers find us. We are rolling on the Writer Files once again. I am honored today to be joined by author Jocelyn Nicole Johnson. How are you feeling today?
Oh, I'm doing well. How are you today?
You know, I'm hanging in there. This is an interesting time in history. It's kind of like a prelude to some sort of denouement or something. I don't know, but we're still in a pandemic, oddly enough.
We really are. And it's strange to have your book come out and be about hard things, but also be excited about your book when the world is, you know, as it is.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the prescience of My Monticello, your lauded collection, novella and story collection. But yeah, let's wind back the clock a little bit and just talk about your superhero origin story as an author. It's a pretty inspiring story, I think, for writers. And you've talked about it at length, some in the New York Times with NPR. But yeah, take us back a little bit, because I understand that you were an art teacher, so you've seen some kind of different, academic worlds. But yeah, talk about your dream to become a writer. And, you know, I understand that you were writing from an early, early age.
Yeah. So strangely for me, that it feels like there's a lot of continuity, because I've basically been doing the same thing since I was seven. And it's just that now at 50, I have my first book come out. Mm-hmm. But for me, I just was a kid that loved making stories, whether it be visual stories or written stories. I kind of did that from the get-go. And as I got a little bit older, I got more interested in how do I make these stories better? So when I was a teenager, I went to the Young Writer Workshop at UVA, which I grew up in Northern Virginia, so that was a couple hours away. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of my first experience of like a workshop and community that wasn't just, you know, a friend reading what you've written, and having someone kind of take the work a little bit more seriously and think about. And I think that's why I went on that path of short stories. Hmm. Because I took a class in microfiction. So it kind of got me on this idea of compression and how can like one word do the work of three words, or where can you leave space and invite the reader to consider something or divine something that's not explicitly written on the page and so forth.
Yeah.
But at any rate, I went to college. I studied art. I ended up studying art and becoming a public school art teacher. And that was my main career. I've taught for 20 years in the public schools in Virginia and in a couple other settings as well. And I love that. And I taught little kids. So a very specific kind of experience there. But meanwhile, on the side, I kind of kept the writing thing going. And one of the main big jumping points was my husband and I, well, my now husband, we were just, you know, boyfriend and girlfriend then. We traveled around the world for a year. We took a year off our jobs. We saved up money. We traveled for a year and we made a blog. This was back before blogs were cool, and now they're not cool again, but in that before times, this was in 1999. And we were kind of wanted to communicate just mostly with our family and friends in the States since we were gone for so long. And so he ended up taking photographs, and I ended up writing these essays about, you know, the things we were doing and trying to convey how it felt to be walking in India along, you know, the river, or being in Brazil, you know, just all these different places that we visited. And that was kind of when I came back, I really thought about writing again more seriously. And I ended up taking a workshop here in Charlottesville. We moved to Charlottesville and got married. And that was the first time I had a teacher say, you should be getting an MFA. You should be submitting things to workshops. And that kind of set me on the path of every summer taking some sort of workshop or class and kind of being in community with people who dreamed of, you know, publishing books and so forth. And slowly over time, I moved into that, kind of moved my sights into that more of a way of just continuing to write and to think about it more seriously than for the end of having a book, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So you were doing a lot of writing in addition to, you know, other things in your life, including teaching and education. When did you realize that this was going to be, you know, something bigger, maybe a career pivot for you?
I think I didn't realize that until I sold this book, honestly. Yeah. I did really start to imagine being able to sell a book. I actually went to 10 House Workshops when my son was about 1.5 years old. Mm-hmm. I was accepted and I went to a workshop with a writer named Amy Bender who does these great surreal stories. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, kind of going from Virginia where I live all the way to Portland and being around a bunch of people who were in MFAs as well as other writers who were not, you know, like a mix of people, a lot of really great teachers there and the people speaking and reading and so forth. And I actually read part of a story, you know, in those workshops, you always have an opportunity to read mostly to your fellow classmates, but teachers will come and so forth. There was a scout there for a literary agent who heard me read this beginning of a story, probably didn't know that my heart was beating about 1,000,000 miles per hour and I was, you know, like super nervous. But I always force myself to read because I think having a sense of audience is really good for thinking about what you're saying. It makes you really think about what you're reading and how it sounds and how it might sound in someone else's ear. There's something about that. So at any rate, that ended up leading me to get my first agent way before I was ready. I didn't have a, they were like, do you have a manuscript? I was like, I could have a manuscript. I kind of basically thought, well, someone's offering me, you know, extending a hand. So I'm going to just see what happens. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of got me on the path of agents. And even though, the book that we developed together and we did submit never was sold, I'm actually still friends with the person who scouted me. So I've kept that relationship through a second agent and now my third agent, my first book going out. So it's been, you know, a long process.
Yeah, as it usually is. And you're probably no stranger to rejection. I know you've talked a little bit about that.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit 1 million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
But yeah, how did it feel to have this lauded short story included in one of the, you know, biggest venues for short stories, edited by none other than Roxane Gay, who's called your latest absolutely unforgettable, for one? Yeah, how did it feel to be included in the best short stories of 2018?
That was amazing and huge. So the story, Control Negro, that ended up was first published in Guernica magazine. Everything about that story was just each thing that story did was so exciting, like from the very beginning, because before it was in Best American, Roxane Gay actually just tweeted about it out of nowhere. I don't even think I was on Twitter, or if I was, I'd never looked at it. And someone emailed me and said, do you know that Roxane Gay is tweeting about your story in Guernica?
That's crazy.
No, I really, really didn't know that. And then from there, you know, just, it was just fortuitous that she ended up being the guest editor for the next year. And so I was like, well, I'm definitely submitting that story to Best American. But Guernica, they had such a warm reception for that story. Writers may know that when you send your story out, when you send your stories out kind of coldly into the slush, you just really don't know. You feel like no one, they've gone into the ether. You're not really sure if anyone ever looked at them. You kind of get an anonymous email. You know, I used to submit way back in the day when you at least got like a slip of paper and you used to have to put your self-addressed envelope in there and there'd be this little slip of paper and sometimes someone would write something really nice on it at the bottom. But at any rate, so when it was in Guernica and they were excited about it and really promoted it, and then when it got accepted to Best American, Best American is such a great venue for short stories because there's so many people who actually teach from that group of stories, who really just look to it for like a survey for those years. It was something I'd already read many years, you know, I'd kind of had random collections, you know, just here and there every few years I would read that. It kind of is perennial. It stays around, you know, our used bookstore in the downtown mall always has like old Best Americans and they're fun to read and kind of gives you a temperature of that specific time and just, you know, and that particular editor. So I really enjoy, that was really great.
Yeah.
That was really wonderful.
That must have been a thrill. Yeah. And the story itself, somewhat prescient, but talk a little bit about that time while you were writing it, because was what was happening in the real world, because, you know, right now it seems that, you know, with the pandemic and these kind of, we talk about almost with every author, the timeliness of some of this work, as it relates to the not only the pandemic, but kind of these concentric circles of crises. And specifically, I think, you know, kind of this, what Democracy Now! Has called the kind of the epidemic within the pandemic of, you know, police brutality and killings of African-American men specifically. But I don't know. Talk a little bit about kind of the prescience of the subject matter, and then we'll get into My Monticello and kind of the overall prescience of the book.
Yeah. So Control Negro was kind of the first story where I knew what the collection would be. It's the story basically of Cornelius Adams, Professor Cornelius Adams, who's a Black professor who is, I call him a Frankenstein-like figure. The story takes the shape of a letter where he is basically confessing to his son that he's been running this kind of clandestine experiment on his son. Meanwhile, his son doesn't even know this, you know, his son lives with his mother and his stepfather and believes his stepfather is his real father. Yeah. At any rate, the idea is this father is testing America's promise of life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness for his Black son by comparing him to what the professor calls ACMs, average American Caucasian males, and kind of editing and manipulating in these big and small ways his son's life to try to make his son so perfect that I think he says America couldn't find fault in him unless we as a nation had placed it there. So it's this, almost this idea is can you escape or can you gain privilege, the privilege that these ACMs have by being perfect enough? And that story I wrote in reaction, you know, this was well before George Floyd. It was well before kind of this moment, this kind of second wave of Black Lives Matter that happened during the pandemic. But, you know, it was certainly after Trayvon Martin. And I wrote it about an experience here in Charlottesville. So we had a university student, a Black honor university student who was bloodied by uniformed officers, like on this kind of crowded strip near the university, and it was caught on tape. And it was a reaction to that more, that closer experience of that rather than the larger one, but certainly echoes of the larger one.
Yeah.
So I was responding to that, but really the story takes that idea and just kind of twists and turns it around, I hope, to a question for me about how can one keep children safe? In a society that has racist issues, you know, and policing, and how, and is preparing your child or trying to prepare your child for that its own kind of injury.
Well, it resonates throughout, I think, your work and some of the, you know, the larger themes in My Monticello, including, you know, as you've mentioned, the idea of place and, of course, Virginia, and then the lenses of racial and environmental anxiety, also more of these concentric circles that we're all having to deal with today. So let's talk about this fantastic collection. So the bookseller called it one of the finest novels of 2021 and a future classic. Colson Whitehead had some very glowing things to say about the book. How do you feel that your peers have received the work? Because it seems like just an incredible outpouring.
I think I can't manage it, so I just kind of pretend it's not happening, and then have moments of excitement and joy and relief and anxiety too, because I think if you can be excited because someone says something really kind about your work, then you can also be devastated if someone were to say something really terrible about it. So there's this way of being really excited that people are responding to your work. I mean, I think when I set out, I had no idea that that would be the response. And it's always exciting even to get one person, like, you know, when you get a note from some teacher that's like, I taught this story and this is really mattered to the student or this person or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's been wonderful, but it's mostly been wonderful, but it's a little unbelievable, honestly.
Sure. So I want to talk about your process, and I think mostly the novella piece, because that does take up the bulk of the work, right? The titular My Monticello novella. But yeah, let's talk about kind of your process and how you find, I think I'm especially fascinated by kind of your background as an art teacher and an artist, but also, as you mentioned, kind of your study of the short story, how that translated into then finding a rhythm for a longer piece for you.
Yeah, so with My Monticello, which is kind of this almost like a chronicle of days told in a first person narrative by Dinesha Love, who's like a descendant of an imagined descendant of Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson, who lives in contemporary times or near future, a slightly apocalyptic near future. that could be now, basically, right? It's not unrecognizable. Well,
it's kind of like that post-futuristic, like 5 minutes into the future.
You know? Exactly. Right? Exactly. But at any rate, I wrote that, as I generally do, mostly not in one sitting, but in one kind of continuous space. I wrote a much shorter version of it, was kind of my first stab at it. And as is often true with me, I generally kind of have been building up an idea in my brain for a bit and kind of energy around it, but I don't know what's going to happen. So I kind of have a beginning place and a beginning premise. And then I'm kind of writing towards what could happen. And it's kind of a blind curve, like, okay, you know, trying to get them, this character and this group of neighbors she ends up fleeing with, kind of what would happen next, what would make sense. So I had kind of the premise that this group of neighbors would be rousted out by marauding white supremacists, really reflecting August 12th, 2017 here in Charlottesville, when we had the Deadly Unite the Right rally, and it was really a trauma for our community. And I had this idea that they would end up taking refuge at Monticello, which is about 10 minutes away from where I live and 10 minutes away from where these characters live, because I place them in my neighborhood, basically. So I had that. I wrote this kind of draft of a long short story, where I had the beginning, I had a middle, and I had the end. I kind of wrote to what the end ended up being. But it really wasn't, it felt thin in the middle, and it was thin in the middle. And it was thin because I didn't know that much about Monticello. I'd been there as a tourist, but, you know, I was kind of imagining what had stood out in my imagination about the place, the physical place, but I wasn't familiar with the upstairs rooms and what can you actually see from the pavilion? Can you see the garden from there? And how would someone live there? And all these questions about creating a space where these characters could be living for a few weeks, and who these characters were too. I had these very thin sketches of the kind of people who were in this bus with her, her neighbors, her grandmother, her boyfriend, her ex-boyfriend, all these characters. But I also had to, I realized I needed to fill out that middle. So I really spent, you know, a period of time just pressing on that and saying, what would be believable? Why would they stay there? How can I take full advantage of this actual physical space and make it feel real to the reader? And so, you know, I went to Monticello a bunch of times and took all the fancy tours and read about it and read Thomas Jefferson's notes on the state of Virginia and imagined more deeply into who these characters might be and how I could hopefully give them, even in a really brief, what ended up still being a brief, you know, a short piece, still give them like breath and life and voice.
You had mentioned just kind of this economy of word and, you know, your study of microfiction, but it definitely comes across in the writing. And I thought one of the phrases you used that was especially resonant was like megastore militias, you know, these white marauders with super shiny weapons that they've obviously just pulled off store shelves. Mm-hmm. A nice phraseology.
It's funny. Can I say one random thing about that?
For
a long time, it was Walmart militias. But then I was like, I wanted it to be more generic. I got rid of some of the markers of now. Yeah. Also, I didn't want to, you know, I'm not loving on Walmart, but I didn't really want to like necessarily call them out in that particular. It wasn't really the point of the piece. It felt like a departure. But I thought Megastore worked really well. I had to think about how I could. I like the idea so much, I had to figure out a way to make it remain.
Well, I understand. So the New York Times wrote a piece titled, "It's Never Too Late to Publish a Debut Book and Score a Netflix Deal," which seems like, you know, and you described yourself in that piece as a literary debutante. What is that feeling? And is My Monticello, the novella, actually what's been optioned as the film?
Yeah. So Netflix, they actually bought the film as opposed to option it. So they're, it's just like basically semantics, but they're actually, you know, developing it. So as opposed to just the, you know, they can hold your things, you know, they buy the option to make it and then they can just like sit on it and then maybe not make it and so forth. Mm-hmm. At any rate, they just bought the novella. So that will just be its own standalone piece. And that was really, really exciting and crazy and also kind of unbelievable because, you know, I started the summer of 2020 wondering, A, what will this pandemic do and what will happen to us, to my family and to my neighbors? And then two, thinking, I wonder if this book will sell at all. You know, this is my third try at having a manuscript go out. I felt like it was a stronger manuscript than the previous two and that it had something to say about the moment. But I didn't know what the moment would be. It was before the storming of the Capitol. It was before the election. It was really a very different time, even this short time between then and now, that so many things have changed. And, you know, it's just been a time. So it was very strange and surreal to be talking to movie people on my Zoom and on the phone. It's very strange, but wonderful that people, it was a really good and really affirming thing that people were excited about the novella and that story. And it did feel like when I heard people say it back to me, it felt like something that you could see, that you could visualize. And so that was really nice.
That's incredible. I can't wait to see that. And I'm sure it's going to attract some pretty big name talent. Do you have any, are you allowed to say anything more about it? Or
I would give you the scoop, but I don't, I think it's still in the works. So I can't give you the scoop yet.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, it's been a pleasure chatting with you. Before we wrap up with your advice to your fellow scribes and just how to keep going, I will mention the book one more time, My Monticello, and described as a formidable book that bears witness to this country's legacies and announces the arrival of a wildly original new voice in American fiction. That is such high praise and so many amazing reviews. We'll drop links to that. Of course, your home base there. Your website is jocelynjohnson.com. I'll link to that. You're on all the socials there. I'll link to Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Anywhere else you want to connect with to listeners and readers? There's a raft of events that you're doing. It looks like you're keeping very busy. But there's an events page on your website.
Yes, so. Go to the events page. We always are updating it about what's going on. Amazing. If you want to pop in, I always say look and lurk, support indie bookstores, buy some books from them, or ask a question. That's always nice.
For sure, for sure.
Yeah, those are my main places.
One quick fun one for you before we wrap. If you could have dinner with any author from any era to your favorite spot in the world, who would you take and where would you take them?
No, I'm so bad at these kind of questions. I feel like you're supposed to be super schmancy. I just want to have dinner with like some writer friend of mine from some workshop that I loved, who's so nice, and I don't have to worry about what important pressure. Thing that I'm going to ask for them. And yeah. Right now, I would love to be in a city without a pandemic, you know, where you could just be enveloped with all the people and the sights and the sounds and not be worried yeah. about it. That would be a nice.
Yeah. And your kind of pearl of wisdom for writers who could use a little boost during this interesting time in history, who might not have kind of the access and how to keep going.
Yeah. A big thing I've been thinking about is building your writing community. And even if you're an introvert, I am essentially an introvert. It's really nice to have people, and to have people before your book, you know, before something big happens in your book life, or whether or not something big happens in your book life. I really think having people that you meet over the years by going to workshops, building your own little writing groups that you can keep up with, you know, depending on your needs, surrounding yourself with people that are going to be both supportive of you, but also, you know, tell you insightful things about what you're making that are helpful to you. Going to, looking around your community and finding, you know, we have like a local writer house community here where you can take little workshops with people, with great writers from the community. Source yourself and find ways to have community around you, because I think that not only does that help you continue to write and improve your writing, but it just makes your writer life so much better. And then you already have these people who care about you and love you. So when you hit it big, you have this kind of community around you to kind of really embrace you and feel involved in what you've done. So don't wait or hope that a book coming out will do that. Kind of do that from the ground up and kind of keep up with people. That's what I would say.
Keep you grounded.
Yeah. And it's just, it makes it funner. It makes it more fun.
Jocelyn, thank you very much for your time. We definitely appreciate you coming on the show. Hope you come back again and rap with us in the future. And best of luck with the remainder of your tour and your future endeavors. We'll look for that Netflix adaptation.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, Kelton, and I hope you have a great day.
Thanks so much for joining us for this episode of The Writer Files. And if you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe to the show and leave us a rating or a review to help other writers out there find us. You can always leave a comment or a question and visit the entire archives at writerfiles.fm. And you can chat with me on Twitter at Kelton Reed. Cheers. Talk to you next week.